This is an interview between Nora Miles and Dennis Crompton. The date is the 19th of May 2008. Right. Your earliest memories of friendship.
Earliest memories, right. They begin in Oxford Street, in the Shepherd Street Children's Home. Now, it took me ages to work out why it was called Shepherd Street Children's Home in Oxford Street. But the Shepherd Street Mission was in Shepherd Street, and they got together and decided to do something for the poor children of the times, and they built this home in Oxford Street. So that's how it gained its name. So in Oxford Street, my earliest memories are of a little room above the main door and my sleeping in that little room. I was on my own there. And the night sounds. I started to listen to the night sounds. I must have been about over two years old. And sometimes it would be summer, I think, and it was hard to get to sleep. And I'd hear these people coming home from the pictures sometimes, or just walking along the street, their clogs would make the sound. And then I started to listen more carefully, and I tuned into what they were saying. And it was, hey, Elsie, I've just been to see that film with Clark Gable. Oh, it's lovely, that kind of stuff. So this fascinated me, all these different acts. And then a man's voice would come in and, come on in, get your chatting away, it's getting cold with the door open, come on. That kind of thing. And then there'd be the sound of a bicycle coming down the street and the whir of the wheels. A car sometimes. That was unusual, but I could pick up the sound of this car. Quite distinctive. And then there would be the sound of the horn. Pa, pa, with this rubber quiet squeezer they had. So those were the main sound I heard in from that little room. My ear got quite tuned into those sounds, and a lot of the things have stayed. Other things about that room were just one occasion when somebody made me a French bed, I think they called it, and I couldn't get my feet right down. It was all night trying to get this sorted out. Whoever it was, I never knew, and they never got any satisfaction, but that's what happened up there one time. At about the age of five, I was about two and a half there, I moved down to the big boys' wing, and this is the boys' dormitory. The boys slept in that particular area, and the girls obviously over in their wing, and the never the twain should meet, except in the dining room. So, in this room, there would be, just as a rough guess, five or seven boys along the row on that side, opposite me, with another five or six along in the next row, and then on this side, about four or five beds, and then mine. And my bed ended just where they went into the toilet bathroom area. Over there, in the middle row, was my brother Fred. Now, this was a bit of a mystery to me, because I didn't work out where I fitted in this particular family for a long time. Dad would call for us. He'd been working somewhere, finding work wherever he could during the Depression. And occasionally he'd come to take us out for about an hour or so. He had to get permission to take us out. He wasn't just allowed to come and take us out. And I've seen the minutes where they've said Fred Crompton applied for permission to take his children out on such and such a day. Permission denied, or permission granted. So they had the control of whether we went or stayed. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Dad would take us out, and there would be Fred. And there was also Hilda, my big sister, and Jean, another sister. And I didn't understand about brothers and sisters because nobody ever explained it to me. So it was quite some time before I realised I was part of the family. In fact, it wasn't until I was about seven and we were due to leave the home to go and live in a little place in Longridge that I discovered that I was part of a family and these were my brothers and sisters. Mm. So in those days, nobody decided that this young fellow needed to know where he fitted into the scheme of things.
So as long as you were cared for, that's all.
Well, I suppose that was the main thing. And they had other things to worry about anyway. Mm-hmm. But for all those years that have passed, there is so little that I can remember of the everyday activities in which we took part. I can remember as boys going and sitting, in summer, going and sitting on the wall outside all in a row, and talking away, and sometimes you get pushed off. One of your mates would push you off and he'd get off and you'd push him off. These kind of things. But there's not a lot to remember about that back area, except sometimes Mr. Slater would come out with a bag of sweets. And they were usually boiled sweets. But instead of handing them out, he'd throw them in the air. Mm-hmm. And when they came down, they broke into bits and you could all get a little bit anyway. That was one way of getting around. And I think they called them Perrys. It was a lolly Perry. Oh. P-E-R-R-Y. For whatever reason. One of the interesting things I remember about that time was they had a, what did they call it, something day, a visit, not a visiting, a gala day of some kind, an open day, when visitors were allowed into the grounds, those who supported the home. It was a summer day, we were dressed in summer clothes, and for whatever reason, we were in, all the boys were put into this long building, on the boys' side, which was a laundry. And they said, oh, we're not ready for you yet. And lunch came, we had sandwiches we brought in, and then it was afternoon, and we were dying to get out and see what was going on. It must have been about 3 o'clock before they said, oh, you can go out now. But most of the activities had gone, they'd all finished. But the band was still there, a brass band, and they were playing. So we all went to them and surrounded them. And I can remember standing behind this man playing something brass, a big brass instrument. And I was fascinated by this, the sound he was making. And unbeknown to me, I suddenly realised I had my hands in his hair and was playing with his. He didn't seem to worry, he didn't say, what are you doing? And I, to this day, I wonder, what did that man think of this young kid with his hands in his hair? But that was a very nice feeling for me to think that he didn't complain. It was only later that I thought about it. Mm. But that's what I'd done. But that's all I remember of that particular gala day, stuck in this washhouse and this short time out in the grounds on that special day. There was one event that we often laugh about in the family, when some of the girls came over from the girls' wing into the dining room, which was under the boys' bedroom, dormitory. Mm. And that's where we all dined together, boys and girls. And my sister, Jean, came in. And Fred used to laugh at this, and later when he told us about it. But Jean came in with one or two others. There was a piano in there. Somebody played the piano. And Mr. Slater was there, and he said, well, these girls are going to sing to you, boys. I hope you enjoy it. And there were hymn songs, hymn tunes that we sang at the mission. And the song that Jean sang as a solo was Jesus Wants Me for a Sunbeam. And Fred used to make fun of all this when she came home. Oh, that was Jean singing this song. I thought, I loved it. I thought it was nice. Mm-hmm. And I had that memory of Jean. She enjoyed singing, but she got a bit embarrassed when Fred played her with her. Yeah, later. So that was those early days there.
How long were you at the?
We went there in February 1932, and we left, I think it was April 1936.
Right.
So good 4 years. Mm. Mm. And we left to go and live in a place called Number 1 Pump Street, Newtown, Longridge.
Those were the new houses.
Yes,
really.
Newtown. And it wasn't necessarily a new house hanging.
Oh, right.
It was just called Newtown for whatever reason. Mm. And there was a pump in the street. And during the war, I sat with my eyes glued to the window in Number 1 Pump Street, watching while they erected this big tripod. They're in Longridge now. This big tripod, and pulled this huge length of lead pipe out in the pump out of the ground. That was for scrap.
All right.
So back to Preston. Little detour there. There was a lady called Miss Horner after we left the home. She'd been a sister at the home too at one stage, and she'd been on the committee as well. But at this point she had a little grocery business somewhere in that area, somewhere close to Berry Road or Berry Street. Mm-hmm. And then in the next door, next street but one, there was this little shop. And we'd lived in Longwood, we came back to Preston. And one day my sister Jean says, it's your birthday today. If you go and see Miss Horner and tell her that you were from the home, she'll give you a cake. So I did. And she gave me a great big hug, this lady, and she said, well, here you are, here's a cake for you. It was a nice big cake. All I remember about it had candied peel on the top. Mm. But it was doubly nice because here was this lady I hardly really knew at all, but she was associated with the home and still had a soft spot for the kids there. Mm-hmm. That was nice. Mm. So that's Miss Horner. The only other thing about that, or that, that's that early area, we've now passed that. Mm. There was one other connection with Selborne Street, which is in Frenchwood, and we had two aunts there, Maud and Edith. They were austere ladies, as I remember. Mm. Single. One was single, one had been married and had lost her husband, and the children had grown up in there. So they lived together in this home. And we visited them on two or three occasions, but always they were the same, prim and very proper.
Very Victorian.
Very Victorian. Nice little place in Selborne Street. But Edith had sit this side of the cabinet with a key, and Maud had that side of the cabinet with a key. And if they were entertaining, they decided, was it Maud's turn or Edith's turn? And whoever's turn it was, the key was turned, and out would come tea and a biscuit or two. And that was there. Their heart was in the right place, but because they hadn't really lived as
they were trying to keep their own independence.
Yeah, of course, and they were like living their own life in their own way, and that was fine. And later on, I appreciate Aunt Maud because she taught me how to iron my own long trousers and get the creases right. Oh. So I owe quite a lot to Auntie Maud. And iron shirts too. So that's Selborne Street. Apart from that, there was the, later on when I grew up, there was the Ribble Motors. Or yeah. Prior to that, there was once or twice Dad took me to barber shops, men's barber shops, really. And there was one close to the home in Stonygate, I think it was on that side of the street, not very far from the school, but I don't remember the name of the shop. And it was a big shop, and there were you entered in a haze of tobacco.
Yeah.
And the sound of coughing and heavy coughing and spluttering, and the snip of scissors would be about three men, cheers. It was all very interestingly decorated with all kind of glass and instruments for cutting hair, stuff that fascinated me as a boy. Lots of newspapers and magazines scattered around. But the thing that concerned me most was these men coughing, especially one down at the lower end, and he was doubled over. And he was really in quite a desperate situation. And nobody seemed to worry. And I looked at Dan, and nobody seemed to be a bit concerned. And I left that with my eyes streaming and my head aching with the smoke, thinking about this man. That must have been a familiar scene in lots of barbers' shops.
Mm. Oh, well, there were the coal miners, and there was all the smoke. And
heavy smokers, and they did it to, well, not just pass the time, but I suppose it deadened whatever hard feelings they had to put up with in those days. That's the barber's shop. And then the Ribble Motors workshop. I went there just before I left for New Zealand. 1952, I think, I went to the Ribble Motors workshop.
Was it the first place you worked at?
No, it was the second. It was the third. I'd been to Telemite, which was a little brake and clutch workshop. Was it New North Road? Meadow Street. Mm. And New North Road, on that corner, there was a gentleman's toilet area there, and across the road was a church of some kind, as I remember. So it was that area. Then I was there about 2 years, went to the National Service Training, came back, went back there for a short time, and then because of it, there was nothing happening there as far as really improving my position, I went to work down at Cleveland Petroleum Company on the docks. Mm. I went there because I was in digs at their particular, with one of the people who was the foreman there, I think it was. Mm. And I was there a short while before I moved to Ribble Motors. And at Ribble Motors was one of my mates from the army. He was a skilled motor mechanic and had his He was doing very well there, but I was in the semi-skilled department. And it was on this bench where I met an amazing group of men, as far as I was concerned. And it seemed to me that I'd had to take step one, step two, step three to get to this particular workshop, and this particular bench to meet one particular man. Now, on this bench, there were two Irishmen. There was who stood out for me, because one was a kind of philosopher and would talk about life and ideas and people's theories and so on that fascinated me. And the other was a great lover of Shakespeare. And he came to me one day and he came dancing down, his little Irishman, light on his feet, his eyes alight. All the world's a stage, Dennis. And all the men and women merely players. And he made Shakespeare alive. And he'd talk about Shakespeare with me. So that, those were two men. The man in charge of the bench was a man called Tony, as far as I can remember. And he was just a quiet guy, thinning it on top, and just gave us our job, what we had to do. And then down at the bottom end, there was the Jack. He was almost bald, and he was on the steam section. And one or two others in between. But they all had some particular aspect of life that they either discussed or talked or shared with me. But the best, the most influential man in that particular group was down in the engine bay. And eventually we all got a turn on different sections of putting this particular chassis, the chassis of the bus, together again. And this time I was sent down to the engine bay, where I took the engines bits to bits, put all the bits in a basket, and the basket went to the degreasing plant. They're all greened, all clean, and came back. And the man on that side put them together. And he was from Poland. And his name was George, we called him George. But his real name was Jerzy Wyczalkowski. And that's not the correct pronunciation, but that's the best I can do. And George and I got on very well together. And he used to teach me a little bit of German. And we got on so well that he said to me one day, as the foreman, the head foreman, walked past, who wore a white coat, the other foreman under him wore brown coats. He was the head one. And he was a severe-looking man wearing rimless glasses, as far as I can remember, and looked a bit sinister to me. And then, as he'd gone past George's Das ist ein Grossenkopf, there's a big head. There goes a big head. So we had a lot of fun. But he taught me all kind of other things. One day, I said to him, George, I'm going to ask for a chance on your side of the bench. I said, I reckon I can put that engine together like you. He said, I know, I've seen you watching me. He says, oh, you've got your head screwed on. He says, sir, tell me what you're going to do. I said, well, I'll go and see the boss. And I'll say, would he give me a chance on your side of the bench for the same wage I'm getting now? And if I can prove the job, would he give it to me, you see? I didn't realise that you had to serve your time, or I'd forgotten about that. And he'd have a riot on his hands. But and George says, well, he says, before you do that, he says, have a think about this. And he brought out this piece of paper from the Lancashire Evening Post. And it said, ex-service personnel from the British services required or requested as volunteers to join the Royal New Zealand Air Force. He says, I know several chaps who've gone out there and doing very well. He said, you do well out there. I said, if the boss won't give me his chance, I'll do it. And just as simple as that. So I went to see the boss, the big fella behind his desk. I never envisaged myself ever doing this, but I got to that stage. I was fed up with this being semi-skilled. I wanted to be skilled in some way. And I put it to him, and he said, no, it's no chance, and shut the door. I said, where's that piece of paper, George? And that was the beginning. And it was George's. You see, I had to go to Telemite, to Cleveland, to Ribble Motors in Frenchwood, to meet George. He was already there. His skill was already there. His gift, and I've learned since that this man, George, or Jersey, he was doing this all the time, saying to young fellows wherever he met them, you know, you could be doing better than this, you could be doing this, and making suggestions that nobody else had thought about doing in this, in their particular case. So he took an interest in people that went a little bit further than normal, just curiosity, and was responsible for helping a lot of people along the way. And since then, I've met his daughter and her husband and become firm friends and shared lots of experiences together. And that's really, I think, about all I can remember about the show in the French Wood area.
But that's fascinating, because it shows that the people within French Wood contributed in their own way.
Oh, they did.
They?
Yes, they did. All those people on that workbench, they were really... I couldn't believe, after I'd left, thinking about it in New Zealand, that those men were still there. They had all those gifts of imparting information and knowledge. They should have been teachers and whatever. Mm. They could have been. What were they doing?
But that was the social life of the times, wasn't it?
They did do that, didn't they?
They did the work. Yeah. They had a job. They did the work. But they tried to make it more interesting, really, than just a monotonous job to get on with.
That's right. Now, there's one other little picture of Frenchwood, the Frenchwood Works. Down in this little brick, what I describe as a small edition of Dante's Inferno, was where the man cleaned all these bits of oil off the bits I'd taken out. They're in wire baskets, and he put them in machine, and it took off the grease. Now, he was small in stature. He was slightly deformed. He was Scotch. And he had a difficulty around his mouth getting his words out. So when they came out, he was sort of reluctant to come out. But he and I got on well. And often, while I'd been talking to George and getting on, I'd nip in there and get some degreasing done and chat with him. And we talked and got a letter from him, still, after I'd come to New Zealand. And he said to me one day, do you think we'll ever get to the moon, Dennis? I said, I think perhaps we might. Oh, no. He says, I don't think so, Dennis. God would have given us wings, wouldn't he? And he talked like that. But we talked about a whole range of things in that. So there was another mind trapped in this body, in that building. You wouldn't... I find it difficult to describe how it was. It was hot, steamy, smelt of this sweet-smelling carbon tetrachloride when it's heated. And yet he had this mind that was asking questions like that and debating it and discussing it. So what went on in other parts of the works, I don't know. But we got on well. But looking at the photographs after, when I left, we all wanted these photographs. There was all these men. I didn't know all of them. I met and I knew some of them. But when they knew I was going to New Zealand, they all sort of hovered round and had the photographs taken. So whether the desire was there or not with them, I don't know. But when I got to before I got to New Zealand, we had lectures in New Zealand House that suggested we mustn't compare New Zealand with UK. Expect it to be different and enjoy the difference. If you can't settle, you can always come back. But it will be a different country, and that's why you're going to go out there. And please don't compare it all the time, because you won't make friends and you won't enjoy the experience. So that was good advice. Mm. And because I'd had that advice, it took me 2 years before I really sort of began to lose the nostalgic feeling and feel at home. And once I got married and had children, of course, it was different.
It was home.
It's now New Zealand, and I'm a Kiwi.
Fully.
Yeah, I'm a Kiwi.
But you like your roots here.
Well, I owe everything, really, and I look back with real satisfaction on my time in Preston and the home. I mean, people cared. Before we ever needed the home, it had been built. Somebody had thought about it. And that was just ordinary people in this little evangelical place. And they got together and built the home. So, yeah.
So... because the home was connected to the mission, would you go into the mission for worship and things?
Yeah, yes. It was a regular trip, sometimes two, sometimes three times on a Sunday. Of the worship service, not much remained, except one. There was one incident, or two incidents. One was a harvest festival, where one of the leading lights went in last. All the goods had been taken in and set out to display. And the last one to enter, after the minister came in, was this man entering. And he held up aloft a big, large bunch of grapes. And that was his offering. And he held it up aloft and took it down. It was very flamboyant. And one of the ladies close by heard her say, he could have taken it with all that force. Right, so that was one image. The second was, it was winter and it was cold and the service had ended and I was waiting outside and this lady came out supported by two others and she was obviously very ill and had been weeping and looked awful. And I heard somebody say, she's got the flu, poor dear. And our eyes met at one stage. And I knew I shouldn't be looking, I should have been looking. But our eyes met and I thought, well, what was the difference between this woman coming out and that man going in? And one was flamboyant and expressing, wanted everyone to see what he was doing. The other was in distress. And, you know, I often wondered what happened to that lady. But there were two images that stayed of that particular mission. But of anything else, there was a scroll on the wall, as they used to have some text. I can't remember what that was. The singing was always bright and encouraging. But there's little else I could remember about it, because it's still quite small.
Well, you were very small.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dennis.
Okay.